Okay, so this is the Sustaining Community Media panel, and I think for those of us who are here, we probably have a lot of different ideas about what that might mean. I mean, we can probably deconstruct the word sustaining and come up with a lot of different sort of ideas of what that means in the short term and what that means in the long term. And for us, as we're doing, there isn't a kind of awareness around it, but I'm hoping that we can like bring together and highlight some of like all the different sort of factions that are present with these panelists, and then we can include some of the ideas and engage all of you in the conversation as well. We definitely would like to see this be interactive. I guess I should start off with just a brief introduction of myself, and then I'll have each of the panelists, starting with Anna, introduce themselves quickly, and then they'll each have 5 to 7 minutes to talk and share some of what they are working on and some of their ideas about sustaining community media from vision to practical application, and then we'll really open it up and get things kind of moving. I also want to highlight that we're not going to be able to cover everything that we want to cover in an hour and 15 minutes, and we don't expect to. We are seeing this as an ongoing conversation. We want to spark a lot of like key points, and then we'll be moving to tomorrow. We invite you all to our strategy conversations, where we will take the different threads and themes from the panels throughout this day and be able to dig in deeper tomorrow morning between 9 and 12 o'clock. And we have a facilitator, and that will be at the Madison in a big, huge room. So please, everyone, feel free to come to that. So my name is Sherry Herndon, and I've been a media activist for 10, 12 years, I guess. I was the news director at KCMU Public Radio. For those of you who live in Seattle, it's now called KEXP. I still call it KCMU because I think it was a takeover by Paul Allen. And then I've been involved since the beginning with the Independent Media Center and other sort of media advocacy projects. So without any further ado, that's me. I'm a moderator, and I hope that we'll all be self-facilitating as we kind of move through this process. So Anna, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Anna Noguera. I'm also with the Independent Media Center, more directly involved with the New York City Independent Media Center. I've only been a media activist for about 2.5 years, so I'm relatively new to all this.
Oh, and powerful.
Thank you. But I've learned a lot in the past 2.5 years, and I have a lot of questions still, so I'm looking forward to the discussion and the session most.
My name is Rahul Gupta. I'm based here in Seattle. I'm the editor of a brand new South Asian publication. It says South Asian, but it's actually the South Asian Journal. I'm not representing South Asia.
Well, we'd like you to represent.
Yeah, wouldn't you all? I haven't considered myself a media activist at any point, but I've always been a writer and a journalist and fighting predominantly in the grassroots level. So I guess by default that's considered media activist by these terms. But I guess going on about 12 years in Dallas, in New York, Olympia, Seattle, Chicago, sort of, but basically. I don't know what else to say.
My name is Karen Turing, and for a really long time, it's a couple of decades now, I've earned a living as an administrator for public education and government access television channels. And those are largely grassroots organizations that provide access to television for people who don't necessarily have the resources, but certainly have the ideas and the energy to do such. And most currently, I serve on the board of directors of an organization called the Alliance for Community Media, which does that same work on the national level. We have an office inside the Beltway, and we really work very, very hard at opening up and creating electronic green spaces from a political standpoint. So we do a lot of legislation watching. We're very clear that a lot of bills never made it into committee because of the efforts of organizations like ours, and that's kind of who I am, what I do, and why I'm here. Most recently, I moved to Seattle actually to to do the transition from a corporate-run public access channel to a nonprofit organization public access channel, which is the Seattle Community Access Network, which is Cable Channel 77. How many people here are local, are from Seattle? Okay, so then I'll make sure that when I, you know, address things to the folks here, that means you can go down here, down to scan and still do that really great, great work.
I'm Sarah Van Gelder, and I edit this publication, Yes Magazine,
woohoo!
Which is published right here in the Seattle area, Bainbridge Island. I started out in media about 20 years ago. I was just realizing the previous panel they asked how long people had been in media, and I hadn't quite realized it was that long until I asked. But I started out as an activist and then realized the things that I really enjoyed about activism were the communications part of it. So I sort of moved into communications, into community radio, into public access television. Then I worked for the cable television company for a while, producing documentaries and public affairs programming for them. I went to China and produced educational videos and then worked for China Central Television. Came back to the United States and helped edit a weekly energy and environment policy publication that was published here in Seattle. And then went to work for In Context magazine, some of you may know of, which quit publication about 6 years ago. And it was at that point that a number of us who were involved in Context decided to form a new publication and a new nonprofit, and that was the formation of Yes Magazine. So do you want me to just continue?
Yeah, why don't we go and start with you for the presentations.
So what Sherry and Susan wanted asked if I would speak about was something about how we've made Yes Magazine particularly work in terms of going from what was basically a broke nonprofit in a basement, you know, with a few old computers, a list of subscribers that we inherited from In Context, but there was basically no money associated with fulfilling those subscriptions, how we went from that to what is now a relatively, in the nonprofit world, a relatively stable, even perhaps thriving organization that that is growing. Our last issue, we printed 48,000 copies, and the first issue was probably closer to 7,000. So we've grown a lot in the last 6 years, and we're doing quite well. And again, in those early days, when we printed the magazine, we had to decide what we were not going to pay for in order to cover our print bill. And, you know, we were working out of a basement. We were doing all the things that probably are very familiar to a number of you about trying to scrape by. So I think the essence of what we've been doing has, you could summarize as being about building community. And that has worked in a number of different fronts. Even though we're located in one fairly small town, we reach a national and international audience, but still community is what has provided the support that's made this publication possible. So one of the forms of that community has been an incredible number of volunteers who work with us both at our office but also in all sorts of other ways around the country to support what we've been doing. So that includes people, elderly people who come in and do the mail once a week. It includes interns, young people who want to learn how publications happen. If you intern for Ms. Magazine, what I've heard is you get to live in the highest cost city in the world and you get no financial support and you get to spend your time filing. When you come as an intern at Yes, we provide a place for you to live, you know, a simple room with a kitchen available, and we provide you an opportunity to be part of an editorial process. So our interns get a lot out of the process, and they're giving us their time and their energy, and that's been very important to us. We've also had something called fellows. These are also unpaid positions that last for a year. People that are mid-career, that have a lot of experience, that come in and are in a position to take a year to do something different. They come in and take on a major area of development for the organization, and they make something happen. And we again provide them with housing. So a very wide range of ways that people can plug in as a volunteer has been part of what has made it work. A second sense of community is one that we've been working to develop with our readership, and I think we have developed with our readership. Part of that is that we've chosen not to have ads. There are no ads at all in Yes Magazine, and I'm not saying that this is something that I would say everybody should choose, but the choice we have made is to treat our readers as part of our community, not as people whose eyeballs we are selling to advertisers, even advertisers we would basically support. So we do that. We address the readers as human beings. We tell them what's going on in our organization. We are very transparent in terms of how we operate. We send them letters twice a year asking them for financial support, and we get it. And we send them also requests that they give gift subscriptions to YES. And partly because our emphasis is on positive futures, it's on possibilities for transformational change, it's on opening doors and inclusiveness and all these kinds of things, people love giving the magazine away to other people. So that's where a lot of our development has come from. So that's the second kind of community, has to do with our developing that sense of community with our readers, who again, through word of mouth and gift subscriptions, really made a huge difference in our capacity to function. A third has been in terms of fundraising. And I think fundraising is something that a lot of our community has a really hard time doing. I mean, for one thing, we sort of have this suspicious attitude towards money, which is it's probably dirty money, and we don't want to have anything to do with it. And anybody who's got money, because they're associated with this dirty substance, we probably don't want to have anything to do with them either. And I think we got to let it go. I mean, I think we need to realize that different people have different ways of participating in something they care passionately about. Some people have time to give. Some people have journalistic contributions, some people have photographs, and some people have money. And they are all people that can be part of our community and our effort. And we just need to get over any hang-ups we have about that. And we also need to realize that people who have money have it for all sorts of various reasons. They aren't necessarily having it because they made some horrible compromises in their lives. And many of them passionately want to be part of the kind of effort that we're involved in. And we can provide them with an opportunity to be part of that without feeling either badly about asking them to be part of it through their contributions, or without them having to ask to feel badly about it. So if we can ask them in a way with a lot of integrity, this, you know, if this is something that meets your passions, you can be part of making this possible. So one of the major efforts that we've been making, and I have to say our executive director spends an awful lot of time working on this, is developing that sense of community, a circle of donors who can provide support for the magazine in the long term. In the short term, one of the ways that we've been able to make it is with foundation support. And foundations, as many of you realize, typically don't support media per se. So we've been lucky enough, partly because our executive director is a former employee of the Ford Foundation, we have been lucky enough to get some serious foundation support, but it's short term. In terms of core support. So one of the things that we look at is ways to develop other related projects that help to support the magazine and other efforts of our nonprofit, but aren't specifically directed to supporting the magazine. So one of those projects is what we call a high impact campaign. Every time we produce an issue of the magazine, it's on a theme. This one's on living economies. We've done them on technology, on global warming, on prisons. Each one is on a theme, and so for each issue, we make copies of that magazine from a few hundred to a few thousand available at no cost to activist organizations who are working on that particular area. And foundations and individuals often underwrite that cost because they can see we've already done the work. The additional cost of providing those extra magazines is fairly low, but the impact is fairly high. So we've been able to essentially suggest that it's a good way of leveraging an investment that's already been made in terms of creating that publication. A second type of support we've been able to get from foundations has been for coverage of specific topics. So somebody wants to see climate change covered, and they want to see it covered in the sense of what can people actually do about it. And some people were willing to fund the issue that we did on climate change, and actually we did it in partnership with the Earth Day Network. We printed 25,000 extra copies of it, and the Earth Day Network gave it away to all of their affiliates. So it's part of part of a gift economy. We give away as much as we can, and we get support from people who want to see that message go out.
Sarah, you're at 7 minutes. Just
go ahead. Okay, let me I'll just mention the topic categories in the other areas, and then we can get back to them during our conversation.
Yeah.
The other topic areas are how the high impact campaigns and some of the other sort of guerrilla marketing have helped us to get the word out about the magazine, because as many of you I'm sure know, promotion typically is very expensive. Another topic area is how we create a sense of community among the people who are actually doing the work, so that we not only sustain the organization, we sustain the energy and the enthusiasm and the sense of passionate commitment that many of us bring to the work we sustain it and enable that to go forward. And again, if we have more time afterwards, I'd be happy to touch on that.
Okay. I think Sarah's organization represents a model that the organization that I do work with, the Alliance for Community Media, is striving to. Our organization is built on a fairly traditional membership kind of model. The goal of the organization is to influence legislation so that people in the various states and cities around the country can benefit from that. I guess our most recent sort of, you know, big thing that we were able to do was to actually change the language of the 1996 Telecommunications Act. And we didn't make a big change. We just put a very few words into that act to allow for local control, or to have municipalities be able to require that a cable company that comes into your city, that uses your public rights of way, your telephone poles, digs up your easements, and all of that, that a city can actually charge for access to that right of way. And that's typically called a franchise fee. In the city of Seattle, it's structured a little bit differently, because our organization believes fundamentally that there could be no cable system if they did not use public property to build that plant. A cable plant is literally built on public property and could not be done so in other ways. But we do take a sort of an inside the system kind of approach to how we want to sustain this public green space, this little slice of bandwidth that is non-commercial and that is available for free expression. One of the campaigns that we've started on most recently is a 10% is all we ask. That's all we want. 90% of it can go to commercial interest or pseudo-educational interest or other interests, but 10% of all of the broadband space, of all of the radio spectrum, of the whole FM spectrum should be this electronic green space where people can interface and do what they feel they need to do on their local levels in that regard. When we talk about, you know, how this particular organization is able to sort of sustain the work that we do, we're a membership organization. So we depend on the people that are interested in our way of supporting this movement to be members and support the organization in that regard. We have on our website a piece of software called the Legislative Action Center. Right now, it basically focuses on federal legislation. Like right now, we're talking about the McCain bill, which would basically strip away everything we did in the 1996 Act to provide local control for public rights of way, which we think are very, very important. Now, the Legislative Action Center is open to anyone who would like to log onto the website and actually literally write a letter to your congressman. Because what we're finding is that even though people are down for the cause, they're kind of lazy with the pen. So we're trying to, you know, in order to, we feel that in order to sustain this movement, we have to make it easy for people to do that. Now, you know, there are other ideas contrary that, you know, you got to fight the good fight and you got to be down for the cause and all of that kind of stuff. But what we've learned, particularly with television, is you gotta hit them when they least expect it, and you gotta make that work as easy for people to do as possible. Because, you know, largely, even when we're speaking in these kinds of events, we're speaking to the converted. So with community television, what you're able to do is reach into the home where people are the least guarded and the most open to receptive ideas and conversation and that kind of stuff. And so we're able to attack at that level. So anyway, we use this Legislative Action Center to allow people to comment to Congress about telecommunications policy that we are also working on, so we speak with a greater voice. We think that, you know, in order for us to really keep that door open, we have to work within the system that we currently have, and that's the political system. So, and we're also, in the next year, we're hoping to offer folks the opportunity to actually hit state legislation and at some point local legislation with that same piece of software instrument. Now here locally, what's about to happen in about, when is this, September? In about 3 months, folks are going to have an opportunity to comment on what the next cable franchise is going to be. And we do a lot of education around that, you know, how you can affect this particular part of the communications and the community media spectrum on a local level. For 3 years, what happens at City Hall and at the cable office is the negotiation of what the next cable franchise will be. That window's open for 3 years. So from 2003 to 2006, expect to see a lot of money being thrown around this particular community around, you know, from AT&T or Comcast or AT&T Comcast, whichever the entity that we will have here might be. And that's basically to influence what this franchise agreement is going to be and how much money we will have to sustain community media and to bring that the public, the educational, and the government access facilities. What kind of money that will be available will be contained in that franchise agreement. And without public comment on these things, that all happens in an office with a couple of people. And people really don't understand how much control they have right here. And we've seen a lot of cities and communities being lost because nobody, when they open the window for public comment, nobody said anything. And so what the municipalities, city staff people, and they're your neighbors, they live right down the street from you, assumed was that nobody was interested in this. And so one of the things that we spend a lot of time working with people on is to support what we had to do to get that language in the Telecommunications Act, to have that local control and be a voice locally. Find out, here in the city of Seattle, it's the Office of Cable Communications. You need to make sure that you're plugged in, bookmark their website, and make regular comments about how important you think this particular little bit of community media is. And in that way, you'll be able to influence it in your own cities and towns. And all over, Seattle is really one of this is really strange and rare community because you have public access, educational access, and government access television facilities available to you. In the surrounding communities, there's educational and government access, but there is no public, and that's because these communities have convinced themselves that what the public has to say is dangerous. So let's let the schools have it, and let's let the governments use these as engines, you know, for, what do they call it? Democracy portals. You can vote online if you have broadband access. And you can speak on issues. The communities surrounding Seattle in King County and some of the other counties are deathly afraid of what the public might say, given the opportunity to say that. So if you live in the surrounding communities, you just need to let them know that it's important to you. Make sure that they understand that you'll be watching them when it comes down to the time for the vote, because a lot of these folks are, even though they're city staffers, you know, their bread and butter comes with whatever legislation is there in place as well.
Karen, thank you. I wanted you to also talk, if you could just briefly.
I know, I was like, seven minutes.
What we had talked about earlier, so that people can have this in their head when we further our discussion in terms of youth and the alternative economic question.
Yeah, actually, I was listening to the radio today, and was it David? What was his
name? David Corton.
David Corton was speaking on something that's really strong and actually becoming a growing thread in my head, and that's cooperative economics. And within our own grassroots media institutions, like if you go out to the lobby, you'll see all of these publications and folks out there doing various kinds of media who are, you know, all about the same thing. But what I find ourselves doing, especially if we have organizations, is that we consistently go outside of our organizations to spend what little money that we have. And there's just something fundamentally wrong about that. How are you going to sustain this, you know, these wonderful things that we're all doing, if you don't put ads in Ethos Day, if you don't submit content to magazines and things like that, if you don't use the resources of the other organizations that you feel ethically aligned with? You can find all kinds of resources. For example, if you need to do board development, you may want to look at an organization that has, you know, say for example, Sarah's organization that has, you know, done a lot of the hard work of becoming an organization and building an institution. You have experts in that organization that you can contract as speakers, as consultants, as things like that. And you're not thinking, at least I find a lot of organizations are not thinking in that regard, to look to other organizations and entities that are doing that kind of work and say, you know, I've got, you know, X amount of dollars in this teeny little bit of budget that I have. Well, maybe I want to talk to the IMC about doing a video piece for me so that I can put this with my grant proposal so that people can understand what I do. You know, that kind of stuff. And I think we need to start thinking along those lines. You know, like, what do I have in my organization that is valuable and will, that I can market, you know, sort of this market kind of economy to other organizations that need this particular resource? And what you find is from your own organizations is now you've created another opportunity for earned income. Okay, and then in terms of the way we spend our dollars, look to non-traditional sources and organizations that have already, that you admire. For the kinds of, what about if you need a bookkeeper or a financial consultant or somebody to help you build your budget or your business plan? You know, if you have to spend money on it, look at entities and organizations that, you know, that you admire and say, well, I could certainly spend my $200, this teeny little money that I have with these guys, you know, and help sustain, you know, keep that money kind of in that circle, like we see other organizations and cultures and institutions doing. And I'll talk about the youth piece the other, maybe later on, you know, in terms of educational and actually getting into the institutional systems and offering alternative media, because most of the colleges and universities basically just churn out journalists or commercial media, or videographers for commercial media. And there are no courses on public access. There are no courses on creating, you know, nonprofit types of media. And we need to be more careful and think about influencing those kinds of things in terms of how we can sustain that kind of media. And, you know, I'll answer your question.
I have to interrupt you just to say there is one course at the KBCS.
No, and that those kinds of things need to be supported. And there's one course at the University of North Carolina in Greensboro, and then one course in New York. There needs to be a curriculum. You know, there needs to be universities that offer entire curriculums for people who want to be storytellers and use technology and one-to-many communications. So that's print, electronic radio, to do that. That, you know, you need to be able to get an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree and that kind of stuff.
Okay, we can, like, that's,
I'm
obviously
so sorry.
A, no, it's, don't be sorry at all. That's like, there's like a lot that's there, and that's like a really important topic, so hopefully we can get into that.
The only thing I might add is, because we're recording this for a later broadcast on community radio, we need to have websites. So if you want to do community action, like your legislative hotline,
okay, well, the Legislative Action Center is on the Alliance for Community Media, and that's Alliance, www.alliancecm.org.
I actually was going to come and talk about, I was asked by Jonathan to talk about a newswire idea that some of us have been tossing around, but I didn't want to, and part of that is the way the South Asian Journal came about there are three extremely negative events that fed into the creation of something that has become, in its first, our first edition came out last month. And for those three negative events, 9/11, the riots in Gujarat, and the India-Pakistan situation, have led to this amazing organizing tool that has already breached that mainstream alternative gap. And so I'd rather brag about that. So brief history, my wife and a friend of ours who's a photographer were sitting down at lunch complaining about the fact that there's no community newspaper or resources other than typical standard newsletters for South Asian communities. And South Asian we're defining as Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Nepal, Bhutan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and then the Maldives, but then the entire diaspora from African populations to Britain to wherever. For all those communities, and we have high representation from various backgrounds. We have a lot of Fijian Indians here. We have a lot of Kenyan Indians who don't associate with other Indians. We've got Punjabis who don't associate with other Indians, they only associate with Punjabis. And then you have separations within separations within separations. It's been a pain in the neck since the broadcast. So our basic mission, and this is where it's kind of contradictory, is we had to start as a for-profit company. We have a competitor in the market who we had to get the name and we had to get it established or we would have been pretty much squeezed out before we ever got started. So we went as a for-profit, it's a sole proprietorship, I own it, I don't want to. We're actually in the process of switching it over to a nonprofit structure, which I'll get to. But some of the things that our mission doesn't fit with for-profit. Our mission is to establish open dialogue between South Asian communities to foster cooperation, mutual understanding, and that evil word, solidarity. And we're looking at this paper as an organizing tool. Organizing, we don't have social services that are ethnically specific to South Asians in this area. We do not have health services that cater to what our needs are. We don't have a political organizing wing, be it grassroots or electoral, that has been effective. What better way to get that conversation going than to put out a newspaper that starts fostering that idea? But we're dealing with second generation, third generation, and recent immigrant. Not only recent immigrant with, you know, green card holders moving here, establishing residency, we're dealing with H-1 visas. So people coming over on contract terms, straight from the homelands, with different political agendas. So it's really messed up. And that organizing tool has to recognize everybody's motivations. That in a given conversation, say dealing with a Muslim Indian about India-Pakistan, or dealing with a Hindu Indian about India-Pakistan, when you get past the rhetoric, when you get them out of being inundated with the quick sound bites, even in Indian newspapers, it's quick sound bites. They mention things as if people know, but then you get on the street and they don't necessarily know what the hell people are talking about. They take that sound bite and they run with it and they establish a very strong opinion based on virtually nothing. You get them out of that situation and there's always one opening, right? It's that opening as a writer where you know that timing to ask that question that's just going to blow everything up, and then the interview takes off in a whole different direction. We've had to do that almost every single time we go out into the community, and it's really tricky because Indians, South Asians in general, are very passionate people. We can go from nonviolence, living side by side, to smashing each other's heads in an hour. And that is systematic socialization that you can't contend with. So you establish an enemy, you have an enemy for life. And there are two things that I've heard so far from the August issue, and that is we are progressive, that we have hit the mainstream, I guess three things, and that we are balanced. Now, that's balanced Hindu-Muslim, that's balanced Indian-Pakistani, that's balanced Bangladeshi, whatever. And no one, to my knowledge, has been able to establish that the first time out. So getting back to that fostering dialogue, it's knowing when to pose those questions, passionate populace, blah, 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 which comes back to the whole idea of social services and the structure of what we're going to do as a nonprofit. We're not looking at the paper as a paper, okay? We don't want advertising, but we're having to go that route. We started the paper on $3,000, okay? We got $525.72 left. I checked the account this morning. I barely have enough to put out the next issue. There's already a demand for more issue, like a higher print run than we did last time. Now that's not much. It's like maybe an extra 150 people, but I still don't have the money to do it. And so you take pretty much the wobbly wheel, pretty much the IMC structure, you've got the hub. So the paper's the hub, right? It's a disseminator of information. We don't have the political end. We need money to cover pop culture. We've got a lot of DJs in town. We've got movies. We've got independent filmmakers and so on. We've got Bollywood, which, thanks to Lagan, now everybody knows about. We've got social service needs. We've got diabetic needs. We've got other health concerns. So we're starting to approach funding from a research perspective. We're sitting down and applying for grants to do research in particular areas to conduct educational outreach into the community. And eventually, that work will, we're hoping, will establish the foundations of what we need in social services and in healthcare and in political organizing. I don't want the paper to control that, ever. I want those aspects to run on their own, but then we will continually feed, because we're going to need that research to justify initial grant work on in any of those areas. So we're going to be doubling up, you know, writing journalistically, writing fluff, because part of that connecting with the mainstream is you have to have Bollywood on one page and then, you know, a documentary on nuclearization in India on the other. You've got to have Vandana Shiva gave us rights to reprint her recent essay. That's on this page. You turn the page before, and there's Miss India, right? And we have to balance that out. And I've already gotten into it with a couple other lefty, you know, media wonkies about how it's almost a concession, and it's not. That's the community that we're working in, and that's what we have to contend with. You can't foster that dialogue if you're constantly telling people what they're supposed to be talking about and framing that discussion for them. It's the very same reason why there's a big separation between ethnic media and the so-called media activist movement. And that is because in ethnic media, we have all these other aspects to contend with, which make sustainability at our levels completely different than what you all have. You have immediate access to public access. We have to go through language barriers to get people to public access. You have, I mean, it goes on. So.
You're getting close to time.
Okay. Two things. Incentives instead of pay. We are paying some of our writers. I don't know how we're going to pay them. I probably shouldn't say this. We're finding ways to pay them. But one of the things we've done in conjunction with our advertisers, especially restaurants or clothing stores or whatever, is that people who write an article who are not part of staff, because we want this to be a community paper. Somebody writes a poem and goes in, they're going to get something in return. They're getting a gift certificate for dinner. They're getting a gift certificate for, you know, 10% off Silvarkamis or whatever they want to get, right? And we're doing that this month, so come back in a month and a half and I'll let you know if it worked. But it's an interesting alternative way to get people motivated, because you have to get people motivated to even pick up the pen, basically. The other thing is the newswire, and this goes into that cooperation model that Karen was talking about, and that is something that came out of the work we did with the IMC back in the beginning there are a whole bunch of us who, not a whole bunch, seven of us who formed our own media collective, Activate Media, which is predominantly just done two documentaries, and they're done by the same person. The rest of us have been debating on newswires and online schools and all this other crap. But essentially, it serves as a clearinghouse. What do you do with the extra money? You can't pay your writers, right? But you have $200 left over. You pay your membership to an independent or a community-based newswire. The money goes to the writers and to operating expenditures. When you write a grant for the organization, you factor in X number percent to cover the operating expenditures. So everyone shares, almost like an interagency agreement. It gets really non-profit-y and really red-tape-y, but it has the potential to work. And I wasn't going to talk about it because we were crunching numbers the last 3 days, and we keep coming up $12,000 short. So every year we're coming up $12,000 in the hole, even if every organization, we made a list of independent publications up and down the West Coast, even if they all come in at whatever they can spend, and we factored in at 2% of their operating expenditure for the entire year. Okay, so there's only a couple $100 per publication. But we haven't factored in the grants, we haven't factored in the donations, and we haven't factored in the donations. And that 12,000 could be recovered, and that's something I'd rather talk about tomorrow or whatever, but essentially it's a membership-based. It's almost like syndication, but where a writer's work is out there, because writers are my bread and butter. Writers are their bread and butter. Writers shouldn't have to do anything but write if they're good. It's a waste of their talent to do anything else, and we need to find a way to keep them writing. And if we can sort of pool our money and share that expenditure, maybe it's $100 more a year that they'll make off writing a particular article or whatever. That's $100 more a year that they didn't have. So we can go into that later, but that's that.
Okay, well, as I said, I'm Anna from Indie Media in New York City. And when Susan and Sherry asked me to speak on this panel, I was very hesitant because I have many more questions than I do answers. But maybe I'll just share some of the challenges that I've experienced in New York and with the IMC in general, and maybe that'll shed some light on what we're facing. The first thing I want to say is something that Sarah said earlier on is, to me, community is the key word in the phrase sustaining community media. And I think that's been proven true with the IMC network in that, you know, we started here 3 years ago with one IMC that didn't really know what it was doing.
We had a vision.
I mean,
it's a vision.
No, I didn't mean it.
We were.
Do you know that 3 years later there'd be 100 IMCs
no
around the
way
world? Yeah. So the fact that just the concept that there are so many people out there with the passion and energy to produce their own media is enough to sustain community media. And as I said, there's 100 IMCs around the world, and they're producing all sorts of projects. I remember when Sherry and I, or mostly Sherry, was trying to come up with a sort of resume of indie media projects and contacting people all over the network about what they're doing, what they're working on. We were stunned at everything that was going on. We had no idea. There's no central kind of command structure to know what's going on. But when you put it all together, it's astonishing what people do with their own passion. And the New York City IMC started about 2 years ago, and it was just, you know, an email that went out on a few listservs, and a meeting was held in somebody's apartment, and pretty soon a newspaper was launched with not $3,000 but $300, and here it is. Well, this is our latest issue. I'm just gonna hold it up. And we didn't know when we started this in September of 2000 that it was going to become an ongoing monthly newspaper with a 10,000 print run, 24 pages, spot color, all that stuff. So we're very proud, and it's all based. I mean, the core is just volunteerism. Nobody's paid. We have no money. Every issue, we hold a fundraiser in the community to pay for it. It's never enough, but nonetheless, we've been chugging along, and there's about 20 people that work on the paper, and, you know, I think our biggest challenge in terms of sustaining community media is if there is no hierarchy, if there is no one saying what needs to be done. And most people want to come in, they take a community reporting workshop, they get excited about doing community reporting, they write their first story, they get published, they learn how to do layout, they learn media making, and that's what they came to do. The question then is, who's going to do distribution? Who's going to do, you know, who's going to manage the subscription database? If we recently, and this is something I want to get into, but we recently decided to accept a limited form of advertising. Who's going to manage that big monster? So questions of egalitarian distribution of work is a big one for IMCs in general, New York City definitely. Let me get into the advertising question, because I think it speaks to a broader issue of what are our politics as, you know, a global justice movement. In New York City, it was a big debate. The people who work on the paper, you know, getting burnt out with having to deal with all these, as we grow and mature, having to deal with all these different aspects of putting out a newspaper, not having enough time to hold the 3 benefits per month it takes to pay for it, are looking for different ways of different income streams. And there's a few of them. We're building a subscription database, and we are having sidewalk sales of people's, you know, used books and old clothing, an art auction of donated community art. But we thought, well, what about advertising? And initially we thought local businesses, which was a model that other IMC papers had taken on, local, non-corporate, non-franchise businesses. But in New York City, there was huge debate, and lots of people were strongly against it. So we've kind of settled with, not settled, but it's a good choice, social justice organizations and other alternative community media groups. And in my opinion, it's not a unanimous opinion, but in my opinion, I think that's what we should be doing, because it's creating not a parallel economy, but an alternative economy, which is what we need to really do in earnest if we're going to build this other world that we want to see happen. So if we publish an ad for an animal rights community group out in Long Island who just contacted us about an event they're holding, and 10,000 people in New York City get to know about it, I think that's a good thing. You know, if they give us $50 that helps us print this, that's also a good thing. So I'm all in favor of it. But it's a big issue, and I think it's one I would love to engage more people on. But then, you know, we've been very lucky. We're in New York City, which is a resource-rich place. We have an office space that has been donated to us for the past 2 years by 2600 Hacker Collective. Computers come flooding in the door. There's no shortage of those. A big question is how we can then send the resources that we do get to other IMCs that are less resource-rich, and we haven't really figured that out yet. But now, starting in November, you know, we've been very lucky with all this stuff, just like the resources are there to do what we need to do and the people are there. In November, we need to start paying rent. It's actually only a quarter of the rent of the place, but it's still $1,000 a month that we just have no, we don't have that, and we have no plans, we haven't been planning for that. So that's another big question, and we've had a few meetings to brainstorm what kinds of alternative methods of fundraising we can create, and they include selling T-shirts, that serves as a publicity, double serves as a publicity thing, having a little coffee shop in the IMC, all sorts of things. But each one of those things raises a political issue. Selling T-shirts, merchandising, you know, are we slowly slipping down the slippery slope into the models of corporate media? A lot of people think so, if we're starting to think in these terms. So it's a big political debate, and besides having to actually deal with burnout and coming up with revenue streams, we're dealing with our own political ideologies, and it's a really interesting time for us. I guess in terms of positive, practical things that we've learned, definitely the networking one is a huge one. Just the fact that, you know, we are a network of 100 IMCs and we can mutually support each other. Seattle IMC has given us money. They helped us fund the issue right after September 11th, 2001, which was crucial. We had 15,000 papers on the street that week, 2 issues actually, 25,000 papers on the street that week, which was the only, as far as I could tell, the only alternative source saying we, you know, not in our name. And so thank you. So creating that network is crucial, and we need to start thinking in other forms of networking like that. And I like Josh to speak to this a little bit later. He's creating a project with Clamor Magazine called Allied Media Project, which is all about connecting all these alternative media groups so that we can learn from each other and create, the magazines and newspapers that do accept advertising, creating an advertising network cooperative, much like the Independent Press Association. For those of you who know them, they are a group based in San Francisco and New York, I believe, and they've networked all the ethnic community press to share the burden of managing advertising and managing distribution. So other models like that, I think we need to be looking at. And that's about it for me.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you, everyone. Really inspiring. We started late, as everyone knows, and if people feel comfortable with us going till 12, and if we feel like going longer, it's lunchtime, and we can do that. I just wanted to kind of quickly, before opening it up to questions and then just like kind of engaging in some dialogue, because I'm sure that we can, a lot of the things that people brought up resonate with folks, and as Anna mentioned, we've got Josh at the back of the room who has a project with Clamor Magazine that he can talk about as well. But I just want to kind of quickly run through some of the things that I heard as we were, as folks were presenting. So that we can just have in our kind of minds. How do we open up more electronic green spaces? What are the challenges or the lessons moving from corporate to nonprofit models? Everything that goes along with training, what does that really mean? Some of us, it's challenging to train folks, and yet it's that mentoring and training is so critical. The challenge about money, the suspicion of like bad money, good money. Indie Media is dealing with something right now with the Ford Foundation. Argentina IMC will not take money from the Ford Foundation for some pretty legitimate reasons of their role with the dictatorship down in Argentina. So those are big questions, this whole strategies about going from short-term to long-term sustainability and community building. The demand that we want to ask for 10% of the broadband space, what does that look like, and all sorts of from local to regional to national, international levels. How do we attract members? That was like a question to me. It's like, how do we bring in and do that kind of outreach, which is about sustaining and community building? How do we make it easier for people to participate outside of the choir? And feeling that they have a voice, getting people to feel like that they can actually comment, creating that voice in the public comment, as Karen was talking about. Going outside of our own organizations, the cooperative economics, which I think is like really that theme has been played in several different ways throughout this conversation. Barter exchange within our own communities. How can we really intentionally do that more concretely and like with the acknowledgement of that that is what we're doing? And I'm almost done, and then we can, so I'll stop talking. Youth. We didn't really get into that, but wow, it's a huge one when I think of sustaining community media. We have no courses. Where's our curriculum about these things? Are we demanding them in our schools? How do we start to like just do it? Start with one course and build on it. Using the magazine as an organizing tool, as Rahul was talking about, wow, that's like, that is what it is. And it's like Sarah was saying, their example of their high impact campaigns. Wow, that was very exciting. This whole issue of incentives and salaries, paying writers, giving people motivation, a lot, you know, in a volunteer-driven, not very much money, how do we, you know, sustain people to do the work that maybe they're gifted to do? And where does that money come from? How do we get the community to support that? The challenge of non-hierarchical movement and organization, for us to really be aware of what that, you know, we've come from hierarchical models, and we're really saying we want to transition to something that does not look like that, but there's a lot of challenges for us to undo that thinking in our minds and in our social conditioning. the egalitarian distribution of work, wow, the creative stuff and the shit work. You know, there are actually some really good models. Michael Albert has written about some of that. I think that those are some good places to look and start to even educate ourselves about that. How to share resources to those who are less resource rich. That's a question and it's a challenge for us. The slippery slope of commercial media, where is that line? How do we hold our values? Developing other models, the one that Anna mentioned with Clamor Magazine and Josh. So those are just a few, some of the themes that I heard. And let's open it up now for conversation and some dialogue.
Teaching note-taking course.
Yeah, I've been a note taker all my life.
How much time is there?
Well, there's 15 minutes if we go to 12, which is kind of what our official time would be.
12:45.
To 1. I'm sorry, to 1. Sorry, yeah.
It's hard to even choose one question among such a vibrant, is really intriguing to me. I've only learned a little bit of that. I'm starting an organization called Within Media and News right now, a nonprofit. I'm at the very beginning of a development program where I don't have any funding and I'm looking to have any number of different ways to make this possible. And then sort of that, so if Karen and maybe also Rahul with the idea of the newswire and the financial incentives that you were talking about, if you could speak in more detail at all about what you mean by cooperative economics and how that actually works logistically.
Well, I mean, for you, it's really simple. It's simple to me because you start off by looking at, again, organizations that you admire. I mean, you know, I think Sarah's sitting on top of a pile of information. I mean, they've gone from something small and you know, at one point it sounded like a bit dysfunctional on the financial side to something, you know, that is pretty sustainable. And you know, in terms of, you know, for her, what I would see, you know, for an organization or an institution like that, and for, you know, your group, is like, if you're going to, you know, if you have to spend any money, that's where I'd be putting my dollars. Or people who have been there, done that, and are actually continuing to do it, can perhaps benefit from, you know, the income stream that, you know, hiring out themselves as consultants and shaman and practitioners of that kind of stuff, or who've been there, would do. That would be one place to start. Is you know, to stick yourself in there, and you know, and then you know, with your resources, offer to pay for that knowledge because it's worth. It has value. You were in there too, Ryan.
Oh, I was, wasn't you?
And also, PS on for you also the newswire.
Right.
When you're talking about paying the writers, when you're talking about the newswire itself, you said it was similar to syndication. Is it a newswire of Salvation Publications, of Progressive Publications, of Northwest, or who's involved?
Right.
You guys.
What I didn't get a chance to talk about was my work with Activate, which was the media collective. What we wanted to do was develop a model by which we could see if this newswire would work. So when my wife and our friend came to me and said, start an Indian publication, I was like, hell no. I'm never going to start an Indian-only publication. They're like, fine, make it South Asian. I'm like, okay. And I called up everybody and you know, from the collective, and I was like, this is what we're going to do. And they had some reservations being so specific to a specific community, but that's what we're dealing with. And so it wouldn't be just South Asian. Because, for example, if I need to prove, from my political perspective, gentrification as gentrification, I might look to an LA writer, or I might look to a, you know, a San Fran, you know, based writer, who may or may not be South Asian, could be Latino, could be African American, could be wherever, right? Could be Swedish. But the idea would be that having access to that article that it didn't have access to before, right? And for a nominal fee that goes to the writer, then we there's not much benefit for the paper except you get to print something, okay? Because you're paying for the print. So you're not making any sort of money off it. Who cares? You're getting the juice, right? So the idea would be that by having access to information we didn't have before, or maybe that article was written better than something that I received from a writer here in town, I can still maybe edit the local piece and juxtapose that with, put that side by side with the piece from LA. And I can get the point across better that I want or the editorial board wants. We don't really have a board. Everybody dukes it out. And it's really messy and a lot of fun. So then that would be the basis of the newswire. So it's not, I don't think a newswire is the right term. We just kept calling it that. It's more like a
article
exchange with compensation for the writers. And that way we actually, as an organizing tool, we get to know the other publications too. So,
hello?
Article exchange.
Yeah.
So there were two hands that were raised, I see,
yeah.
Or three actually. Yeah. Why don't you go first? Yeah, you guys can choose between yourselves back there.
Okay. This is just a question for Rahul.
Rahul.
For Rahul. You said something very interesting about the distinction between different types of challenges that are faced by what you determined. I've never heard a phrase like this, so it really stuck out for me between ethnic media versus what activist media. I've never heard. If you could kind of elaborate on what you find those different challenges to be, because just as a local activist, I've been involved in different activist movements, like they're quite frankly predominantly white anti-capitalist activist
right.
Community that's kind of centered around the IMC, and different activist actions with the African American community and the international district, and there are differences, but I've never really been able to kind of articulate what the different challenges are. So I wondered if you have additional insights.
You've got a table. You've got a table with panelists, and I got a call to no, that's not true. I got an email from a friend of mine in New York about this conference, and I never heard about it. Neither did anybody from some of the local, people of color, publications. Now, they might have gotten an email, but I don't know about you, but I need a face-to-face. I need that phone call. And true outreach is, don't send me this blanket thing that, I may not see where I fit in, because you've already defined the playing field. You've already defined it. All that academic stuff comes back, right? You've already set the framework. Now you want me to plug in. But in reality, I've been plugging away anyway. So where was I in that discussion? Or where was, I'm going to point you out, Naomi in that discussion?
She was there.
Actually, I was there.
Were you really?
She
right
was
on. Okay, I had no idea. When we talked, you never told me that. Okay, but cool. But for example, there's so many more.
Well, it is pretty common. And that's with all movements, that have happened in our society historically. There are really great writings about the women's movement not necessarily doing anything for women of color, but they wanted to scoop us along with it too. And that's always the risk you take, when you start a movement, is, that you don't leave somebody behind. But, And frequently when we go out and speak or do or engage or plug in, we find again the infrastructure is already there, and you just have to sort of dig in there and bring up that cultural perspective from kind of wherever you're standing or wherever you happen to be plugged in. But you also I've had to learn to recognize that there is sort of this common language, and please forgive me, I certainly don't mean to offend anybody, that white people understand when they talk to each other. And sometimes because of our cultural differences, because of the, like you said, you do more face-to-face, better than just a blanket email. And so it's even understanding just that those kinds of ways that you need to plug into people. Some communities, in terms of, you know, whatever your movement is, they don't respect you if you don't come to them. You know, if you know just because you sent an email or a press release to this particular, you know, community, doesn't necessarily mean that you have reached them, you know, until you get in there and try and fundamentally understand how they consider being respected. You know, in some, you know, in Chinese communities, your word is your bond. If you say you're going to be there at 7 o'clock, you better be there at 7 o'clock. And that's just, you know, just some really, or even called South, in the South. If the meeting starts at 7 in the South, because I spent a lot of time working down there, you better be there at 6:45 ready, because at 7 o'clock the meeting's going to start. And anybody that's there after 7 o'clock is disrespecting the people that came on time.
Yeah.
And in Seattle, that's so totally different. You know, and so when I moved here from the South, I felt, you know, I would just be totally just like feeling very disrespected, because I would show up at city meetings with city staff who would saunter in there 10 minutes late with a cup of coffee in their hand, you know, and I was just, but that's just Seattle. And so for me, it was understanding Seattle culture,
yeah,
you know, and for them, they needed to respect the fact that I was from the South, and that if they told me to be there, they should have told me to be there at 7:15. You know, if that's when they were going to be there and that's when the meeting was going to start. So it's really about, you know, having to do that extra deep thinking, you know, for our white allies to do that extra deep thinking and reach back and, you know, say, this is what we're trying to do. How should, you know, we plug you in? And, you know, sometimes you do have to represent your race, because, you know, sometimes we're all that people, you know, we people of power. People of power have, you know, are there connections to us as individuals, you know, so it's like, well, what do your people need, or, you know, it's just a matter of just kind of figuring out that kind of stuff. But in this particular case, I do feel like there was questions asked, like, there in the very beginning when the organization of this particular conference started.
There's a name for that coming in 10 minutes late.
What?
It's called dominant culture.
Yeah, but you know, yeah. With Indians, it's called IST. It's called Indian Standard Time.
Or yeah,
I mean,
no,
like,
it depends.
We operate differently.
Or CP time,
which is
colored people time.
But I mean, and so when you show up to an event for an Indian thing, even as a if you're covering it, you could basically gauge that half an hour will go by before that event will start, and that's just, I mean, so I guess we all pretty much know when to show up.
But it's part of your culture, and, you know, yeah, for other people to sort of respect and understand that.
I'd like to point
Is it like a process question? Because we do have questions that were maybe before the site. Yeah.
Like that in some kind of coherent process, you're recognizing people you're going to speak to.
Yeah.
I'd like to point out one thing, too, that what I'm finding is the more forthright and uncompromising an activist you are, the more you tend to get marginalized by your culture, regardless of the culture. That's what I've seen in Seattle recently. And so I kind of overcome that by being sensitive to people and also writing on the diversity of issues that even the fringe might be interested in. Because there's a cross-fertilization, a fusion that occurs. And one thing the city is disrespectful, and I apologize for that.
Okay, can we have the hands back here? So we have you, and then let's go to Josh, and you, and then Naomi.
I just wonder if people on the panel could comment a little bit about. I was listening to some of the things Anna was talking about process and some of the challenges around that and in having an egalitarian workflow. And I wonder if people, like, I know Sarah, you talked about your project being a success and thriving, and I wonder if there's kind of a fire behind that smoke. There's fire in terms of how you organize and what kind of values you bring to organizing as a media group.
Well, I started out as an activist, so I worked in situations that were completely collectives, where everybody had exactly the same authority, no matter whether you'd walked in yesterday or whether you'd been, you know, slogging away for years. Everybody had the same authority and could do whatever they wanted. And I basically don't believe in it. I believe people bring different strengths and different commitments to what they do. And I think it's kind of both disingenuous and destructive to go to the extreme of saying it doesn't matter what you bring or how much commitment you have, we're going to treat everybody exactly the same. So I'm not saying that we've got this all figured out. I'm just going to tell you what we do, and it seems to work. We try to look at the work, the varieties of tasks that need to be done as all important and all deserving respect, and we don't have anything we categorize as shit work. We have somebody who's been managing our database for customers since day one. It's what she loves to do. She would not want to do some of the other jobs, and when there's been openings that she could apply for, she hasn't chosen to do that because she's very happy with what she's doing managing the database. And it's also a very respected position as far as the organization is concerned. I'm the editor of the magazine. At the beginning, I was also the executive director, and I was also the person who fixed all the computers and, you know, whatever else. Now I don't have to do all of those things. But as we grew, I really focused in on what I wanted to do that sort of met my own goals and my own passions and capabilities. And I realized that being executive director was not what I wanted to do. And when an opportunity came up to hire somebody to be an executive director, I jumped on it. We now have a fabulous executive director. I don't have those headaches. She has an enormous, you know, creative spark that she brings to what she does. I'm still on the board, so in some respects, I'm part of, she reports to me as a board member. I report to her as executive director. We all get along great. So, and we have a philosophy that responsibility and authority go together. So if I take responsibility for making sure that every issue of the magazine is going to come out and every issue is going to be as leading edge as we can possibly make it, I also have the authority to do that. So nobody's telling me how the magazine is going to be done. On the other hand, the whole editorial team is part of the process of developing that material. And also, there's a lot of consultation within our editorial process. And board members and others weigh in with their own ideas. But it's basically